Welcome to the first episode of the Canada History Society podcast. We will be using this podcast to interview academics, politicians, and subject matter specialists, and hopefully provide you with genuine insight into some of the more exciting, controversial, and formative elements of Canadian history. This episode is the first installment in a two-part mini-series we will be doing on Richard Blanchard, the first governor of the colony of Vancouver Island, and one of the most important figures in early British Columbian history. We speak with the very esteemed Canadian historian and biographer Barry Goff, who is a professor emeritus at Wilfrid Laurier University, and who, over the course of his five-decade-long career, has published a dizzying 22 books on maritime and naval history. He's certainly one of the most respected contemporary Canadian historians, so we are very pleased to have him on the podcast. So without further ado, here is our first episode on Richard Blanchard. In 1850, the colony of Vancouver Island, which was situated along the rugged west coast of North America, was a nascent settlement with promising potential. The year marked the arrival of its first governor, Richard Blanchard, who was appointed by the Hudson's Bay Company, which held the trading rights to the region. Blanchard's appointment was met with anticipation as he was tasked with establishing a functioning colonial administration and fostering economic growth. However, his tenure was fraught with conflict, particularly with the powerful Hudson's Bay Company. Blanchard found himself at odds with the company's dominance over trade and land allocation as he aimed to promote settlement and encourage private enterprise. The tensions escalated as Blanchard struggled to assert his authority and fulfill his responsibilities, eventually leading to his resignation in 1851. While his time as governor was short-lived, Blanchard's struggles highlighted the complexities of colonial governance and the delicate balance between administrative authority and corporate interests during this pivotal period in the history of Vancouver Island.
I want to talk about the importance of 1849 in British Columbia history, not 1858. It's not that 1858 is not important because of the BC Gold Rush, but the beginning point for the modern constitutional history, at least, is 1849. And it's the climax of what had happened in the 1840s in North America. And the scene really opens in a dramatic fashion in the convulsive 1840s, because the Americans, or the United States more specifically, were questing westward. And Texas and Mexico, California and Oregon were all acquired. And do you know that 1,366 miles of real estate were added to the United States coastline in the period from 1846 to 1848? A phenomenal growth. So in these circumstances, Britain's claim to a transcontinental empire in the future Canada was being placed in jeopardy by what is sometimes called manifest destiny. That is to say that the United States would move north, would cross the 49th parallel as set forth in the Oregon Treaty of 1846. So we have two imperial powers vying for control. And they're very different powers. On the one hand, you've got one which is backed by the U.S. Congress and the president and a territorial system that's being established in Oregon and later Washington State, and backed by the American Army and the American judicial system and all the controls of military authority. And on the other hand, you've got the Hudson Bay Company in retreat and using the same old styles of imperial arrangements as heretofore. So you have a formal empire on the one hand, on the south, facing an informal empire on the north. And the to make it an even more complex problem, the British government is very soft on the concepts of defending the northern realm. And the reason for this is that the free traders were in powerful positions in Parliament. Empire was a bad word. It was regarded that no new addition should be added to this huge worldwide empire. that was already getting the British into trouble. As one person once put it, there seemed to be a British flag everywhere on an islet or rock where a cormorant could perch. I love that. But this is this case, and people like James Stephen at the Colonial Office said, look, we got all these places, we're going to have to defend them, and we don't want to do that. So this is an era of great economy. So it was in these circumstances then that some very dramatic things took place in our locations on the West, far West. The California Gold Rush, first of all, the proclamation of the Oregon Territory. A couple of years before this, the Whitman Massacre near Walla Walla. Then we get in 1849, the transfer of the depot of the Hudson Bay Company from Fort Vancouver on the Columbia River to Fort Victoria on Camosun Waterway, Vancouver Island. And to complete the list, there's the creation of the colony of Vancouver Island and its dependencies. And to represent this new colony, a Mr. Richard Blanchard, a barrister at law, a little known figure with no colonial experience, is thrown into the mix and is sent to the far side of the world to become governor, a civilian in a corporate world, a totally corporate world, because the Hudson Bay Company is dominant, has been dominant in the far West since even before 1821, when the merger of the Northwest Company and the Hudson Bay Company occurred. So we have a situation here in which a very powerful Britain worldwide, in its industrial output, in its machinery, in its inventions, its spinning and its weaving, its shipbuilding, its shipping, its insurance, its seaborne trade, is now adding to the formal realm this little place called Vancouver Island. London was the world's banker. Britain was leading in naval and mercantile seamanship. Britannia ruled the waves. And not least, the surplus population of the British Isles was flowing overseas, forming colonies and dominions under the Union Jack, and in doing so, reordering the spaces occupied by Indigenous people, a constant story of our studies here. The sordid trade in slaves to the Americas, from which Britain had so shamefully profited in the past, had been stopped by British diplomatic pressure and Royal Navy coercion, and plantation slavery had been abolished in the British Empire, and the plantation owners had been compensated. But in every place, there were difficulties, and imperial obligations seemed to spell what I might describe as bureaucratic quagmires for British ministries. And Benjamin Disraeli, a very eloquent imperialist in a later era, contended that colonies were millstones around our neck. And other statesmen thought similarly, believing that free trade would make empire obsolete. So trade, not dominion, counted most in this logic. And still, the idea that colonies could cut adrift was in the works, but it was never really formally considered. Now compare the American situation or the United States position in these same 10 years. Texas, Mexico, and California came under the acquisitive view of proponents of manifest destiny. The rhetoric of restless United States statesmen matched ambitions by settlers to have farms and ranches in soil-rich Oregon. And the incomers had been led to believe that the British and the tribes would melt before them. After all, this had been seemingly the case in Eastern North America. Wouldn't it be exactly the same in the far West? So the American Empire was marching side by side with this concept of destiny towards Pacific shores, and was threatening to turn north. So this is the backdrop then for the far western drama which is played out. And the central feature of the story, of course, is the Hudson Bay Company. They are selected by from a number of applicants, selected by the Colonial Office and the British government and the Queen to be the holders of the far realm of the British Empire. And why is this the case? Because they already are there, and they've got investment in forts, they've got a trading system, they're doing business on the Pacific coast from Alaska all the way down to Hawaii and to California. And it's a working proposition. It's fallen back from the Columbia River, but it's now based in Victoria, Fort Victoria specifically. So it's in these circumstances that Governor Blanchard arrives in March of 1850 as the Queen's representative to be the constituted guardian of the Northern realm. And although bearing a royal commission, and he had even been recommended by the Hudson Bay Company, it remained to be seen if he would be a misfit or would find a place among the field officers of the company on the spot. Now, in great matters, as Admiral Lord Nelson once put it, something had to be left to chance. And poor old Richard Blanchard sets forth for the Americas with the hopes that he's going to be able to make a career on the basis of some promises of some land and some salary. Now, to close this little discourse on the origin of the colony, in the background was always the concern about what would happen to the indigenous peoples of the far northwest coast. The Colonial Office and the British government, the Aboriginal Protection Society, the Aboriginal Slavery Society, the Church Missionary Society, and other organizations were very familiar with what was going on south of the 49th parallel, where quote-unquote Indian wars were going on all the time. But there was another thing too. What would the Hudson Bay Company do in relationship to indigenous people? Would they protect and guard them? Would they continue to trade with them? And what would be the future of the colony of Vancouver Island in such a circumstance as this? How can you promote a colony and set one down when, in point of fact, you're trying to protect the fur trade and save the fur trade, and, of course, to keep the arrangements with the indigenous people up because they're essential to the fur trade and to the connection with the company. The famous William Ewart Gladstone, later a longtime prime minister, had been colonial secretary in 1846. But in 1848, when there was a big discussion about what was the future of Vancouver Island, he said, I guess it's sort of disparagingly of the Hudson Bay Company, or perhaps more likely realistic. He said that the Hudson Bay, and I quote from Hansard, was of necessity an anti-colonizing company. It was in their interests that the natives should be kept as closely as possible to the barbarous and savage state, because in that condition, they were the best hunters. That's a powerful statement, among many others that he made at the time. But it points out to the fact that he and others would realize that in the circumstances of the colony and the way it was being set up under the Hudson Bay Company, the moving forward, if this is the right term, of indigenous people towards education, employment in the industrial world, taking a role in trade, et cetera, was not in the interests of the company. They wanted to keep, as Gladstone would imagine it and describe it, they would want to keep them in a situation of, quote unquote, can I call it servitude in relationship to the fur trade company. So these then are the circumstances in which the colony is set forth, it would remain to be seen how all of these ideas would work themselves out. So that closes this section.